Welcome to the Athletic NBA Show,
Monday through Friday,
on the Athletic Podcast Network. Welcome to Tampering.
For this beautiful game of basketball that we all love and talk about every single day.
With Sam Panic.
To be able to bring people together.
Reportedly at the center of an NBA investigation
into tampering accusations.
And the message to executives in the league is
stop talking about players on other teams.
What did I do?
The charges filed.
Impermissible contact.
Right or wrong?
Tampering charges are really difficult to prove.
You know me, I talk.
Kind of awkward to even talk about. I can't even mention teams anymore.
Ask me what I like to play with Kevin Durant.
You try all you want with tampering.
They're always ahead of the rules.
It's not rocket science.
Everybody, we don't think I've tampered with the guys.
I didn't tamper. I'm just telling you what happened. I'm just telling you what happened.
Hello and welcome to the Tampering Podcast, part of the Athletic NBA Show Network. I am Sam Amick, NBA writer at The Athletic. Here, as always, we got a lot to get into this week. We got hoops, we got COVID updates, which are no fun, but we got to get into the way that the league is getting impacted in a pretty serious way. We got a couple usual suspects on the line. Fred Katz, Wizards beat writer, East Coast representative. Fred, how are you?
I am trying to remember what it's like to cover NBA games, but other
Fair.
Than that, I'm great.
Fair. Yeah, I hear you. We'll get to that. Out west, we got Anthony Slater, Warriors beat writer, part-time Lakers, backup beat writer, extraordinaire. Slater, what up, brother?
What's up? A lot of basketball. We're talking to the listeners on a Monday when it was the MLK full slate. It's been a
good
day of basketball.
Good day of basketball, meaningful day, of course, especially in these times, and in the middle of the country, coming to us from the great city of Houston, we have the one and only Kelly Eco, Houston Rockets beat writer.
Yeah.
Kelly, my guy, what's going on?
What's going on, brother?
Kelly, I hope this stream shows up on the YouTube channel. We haven't decided yet if we're going to have video. I don't know what Kelly has going on. He's inside a cardboard box. He's in the studio. He's got the Beats by Dre headphones on. I mean, Kelly, if it works for you, I'm with it. But, like, tell us what the setup is, you know, going on here. What do you got?
So my house has a lot of wood in it, and everything echoes. So when I used to do podcasts in the other office, like, it was, like, real grainy. So I had to go to FedEx, do a little DIY project, give me, you know, the soundproof foam. And then voila, budget cuts.
The part I'm loving is you sound great. And listen, your voice is extremely familiar to me right
hey.
Now. You and I just spent the last 3-4 days.
Dude, I went through my call log. It's like Sam Amick, Sam Amick, Sam Amick, Sam Amick, Sam Amick, Sergio.
And we always, right, NBA editor Sergio. We always love having you on the pod. I think this might be like visit number 2 or 3. So good to have you back. But, today the topic, of course, where we're going to begin is all things James Harden. And I know the listeners, you know, who knows, maybe there's a little bit of Harden fatigue. This story has been front and center for the entire NBA season. But you and I, you know, after the trade to Brooklyn last week, is it Wednesday? Is that right?
Yeah.
When the deal went down. After the trade, you know, we wanted to kind of do in true Athletic style a deep dive to find out, you know, what was it like for James, for the Rockets in the final stretch of his time in Houston. You're talking about 8 seasons in that city and a guy who went from being a sixth man in Oklahoma City to an MVP and trying to get to the top of the NBA mountain, wasn't able to get there with the Rockets. We worked hard on this story, trying to be fair, trying to uncover some new stuff. But I want to have you kind of give the listeners, you know, the Reader's Digest version of this. You know this team really, really well,
right.
And you know this saga really well, but like, what were your takeaways from this story and things that, you know, maybe you didn't even know going into it that you learned?
I think the biggest takeaway for me personally was how quickly it turned sour. Obviously the tipping point, as you should know by now, was the Rockets team meeting after the Lakers blowout loss. But even prior to that, like the 3 games prior where Harden's body language and his effort was, you know, all the way down, it just seemed like if he wanted to leave, you know, that was a pretty easy way to kind of telling everybody that, you know, he's checked out. And it's kind of ironic how Calvin Murphy, he was on the air and he got a lot of backlash for saying that he quit.
Former Rocket, Calvin Murphy.
And he was getting a bunch of just, you know, backlash on this comment because how could you say that about, you know, the franchise cornerstone? But look, like he checked out. And I think from that
Kelly, real quick, yeah. Sorry to jump in, just in case somebody, you know, if people didn't see it, it was one of those classic cases of a TV personality not knowing that the mic was still hot, right? So like they're talking about the game, they're breaking down the highlights. Calvin is saying all the politically correct things on the air, and then as they go to cut to the break, you hear him muddle, you know, kind of mutter like he quit. And I mean, that made a difference, or at least kind of resonated because of who he is and his history with that franchise.
Right. And honestly, I think the most polarizing thing, or the thing that stood out to me the most, was the fact that you have Steven Silas, a first-time head coach, who's been put in this awkward situation of trying to lead a team and also trying to manage his, you know, superstar who wants to leave. And you know, he has the meeting, he calls the meeting, and you know, they make the decision that Harden, and even at this point, they're not sure when the trade is going to happen. It could happen tomorrow, it could happen next week, it could happen at the deadline. But he made the decision to keep Harden away from practice, like away from the team, at home, until they can find a resolution. And you know, lo and behold, the next day, Harden gets traded. But just how quickly it went from Harden saying this could be something special, him looking like an MVP candidate the first three games of the year, and then just going from 100 to 0 was really astonishing.
Yeah, I mean, what about that for you, Kelly? And guys, I want you to jump in here too after this, but like, it wasn't that long ago that James talked pretty consistently about wanting to retire with the Rockets.
Right.
And I know that because you'd been covering his trade demand for a couple months now, yeah, maybe you get, you know, you kind of forget that part quickly, but like, if you really kind of hit the rewind button and look back, does that part still strike you, that, you know, how quickly he went from
it's just one weird night? It's just weird knowing that, well, obviously it's different now because of COVID, but like, if we were around the locker room, it would have been super weird to see a Rockets locker room and not see James in there, you know, like he was kind of symbolic of that team for almost a decade. And you know, when every time you hear players say, you know, I can retire here, I want to play here forever, on one hand, you kind of take it with a grain of salt. But with Harden, it just seemed like everything in the city was for him. Like, obviously, you know, he loves his social life and everything. He opened up a restaurant recently in Houston downtown, close to the arena. But just the way that the team was designed in his image and the organization did everything that he wanted, it felt like this was going to be the place for him to play the rest of his career. And you know, it's kind of good to see that players also have their legacies, and you know, winning means everything to them. For certain players, it means more than others. But
right,
for James, although he could have done it in a much better way, much more professional way towards the end. At the end of the day, if he wants to win, who's anywhere to say he shouldn't, you know, have that chance? He's given the city a lot.
Yeah, and I think if you strip it down, it's 31 years old, never had a ring, right, and you know, and it got messy, but yeah, that certainly was the driving force.
What's the local vibe in Houston? Because it's just, it's funny, a lot of times from an NBA league-wide perspective, we forget, you know, that a lot of sports are tied together in these cities, and I just think it's got to be such an interesting time there when you have this Harden situation, him blasting open the Rockets, at the same time Deshaun Watson, who, I don't know, is he a bigger star in Houston?
Yeah,
he
seems to be doing Deshaun that to Watson Texas. Is a bigger star, I would say, because... Yeah.
So what's just like the on-the-ground feel for like what is going on in that sports city?
I'm not sure if you're allowed to curse on this show, but it's a shit show.
Let it rip, Kill.
It's a shit show in Houston. You're seeing from the fans, I guess, utter chaos in terms of what the hell happened from 2.5 years ago until now. You know, when you see the Astros winning and the Texans have a young bright star and the Rockets are winning, and now Harden's gone, the Astros are crumbling, and the Texans are, if they're on, already crumbled. Like, it's really crazy how quickly sports can change on you. And it just shows that, you know, if you have a window of opportunity, you have to be as aggressive as possible. You have to make all the right moves and do all the right decisions to get over the top, because you never know when that chance will come again.
Kelly, I'm curious to ask you, because you guys mentioned this a little bit in the story that you wrote for this morning. you know, obviously James Harden is hardly the only change. There's the Westbrook trade, and there's the changes all across leadership with Daryl Morey being out and then going to Philadelphia and Mike D'Antoni being out as well. Let's say, and I understand this probably affects the fabric of the organization in a way that kind of changes the situation a lot. And maybe you can't even answer this because of that, but let's say that, that Daryl Morey is still there and or Mike D'Antoni is still there. Does this situation play out differently if that's the case?
I think so.
If they decide, you know what, it's been weird, but let's keep D'Antoni or something like that?
I think so. And that goes back to if you look over the NBA and sports in general, you see it's really hard to get synergy. And the Rockets were one of the few organizations, I think the Warriors like that too, where you see the star player, head coach, general manager are all on the same page. They all make decisions in accordance with each other, and they all understand, you know, top to bottom what they want to do. And I think the Mike thing was really shocking because, honestly, I think Mike leaving pushed Daryl to leave. And once James saw, you know, two of the three parts of the triangle of success, he was like, you know, if they're gone, why am I still here? And I think if you look across like other NBA teams, you'll see if there's ever a disconnect between either the star player and the coach or the star player and the general manager, if they see things differently, more often than not, you know, there's going to be, you know, a departure or two. So I think for James and for Houston in general, had those guys been there still, I think he would have maybe stayed a year. I give it a season more if he was here. If they were all still here, I think he would stick around.
You know what gets lost, guys, though, in that, like, the domino effect of how this whole thing went down? Because, like, Fred, to your question, I 100% think that, you know, James would still be there if D'Antoni was there, if Morey was still there. But you got to, before you get to that point, you got to go back to when Mike decided to leave. And we wrote a lot about that at the time. It was, again, kind of messy. But one thing that honestly has been glossed over and we didn't really hit on in this piece either is that I get the sense that when you look at Mike D'Antoni and where he was at in his career, like, okay, yes, he was not happy with the lack of an extension and the negotiations hadn't gone well. And the relationship with Tillman Fertitta, the Rockets owner, like we've written, played a part. But the glossed over part is that I do think if you got Mike to get a couple beers in him and talk about that Rockets roster and where this talent was going and like the, you know, where his motivation level was to remain, I think that played a part too. And so whether it was Mike leaving first and the dominoes starting from there or whatever form it all took, I do think that because they had banged their head against the wall so many times in the playoffs, there was kind of this kind of looming sense of that the end was nearing of this era. And Slater, you covered those Warriors through that stretch where they are the team that kept James from achieving his professional dream. And, you know, it had a ripple effect on all these human beings. And then now we kind of see the scattershot impact on the arc of their career.
Yeah. You know, dynasties tend to do that, or, you know, the end of, there's one team that's really happy at the end of the season, right? Everyone else kind of has to reassess where they are. I mean, we go back to the Thunder. The reason why Durant was even with the Warriors was because the Warriors kind of blew up Thunder a little bit. But it's interesting kind of where this is all landing, especially with D'Antoni in Brooklyn. I thought that's kind of like an interesting part of this that hasn't really been discussed much. The one thing I wanted to flip to Kelly just on the end of like the Houston style of this, I was kind of surprised that they went and got Oladipo instead of keeping LeVert. Now, the sadder part of this is what's happened with the Caris LeVert situation. But where do you sense Houston's going? Like, are they trying for like a quick rebuild? Do they just want to get under the luxury tax? Or is this going to be like the long haul? Like, when's the next time we feel like Houston might be relevant?
So it's interesting. For so many years, the Rockets have been known for, you know, their offensive ability, top five in efficiency for, what, 5 or 6 years. I think with Steven Silas, and he had a big part in, you know, the decision to bring Victor here. He talked about his two-way ability. And between him and John, assuming John can stay healthy, I think the Rockets, they want to build a defensive identity in terms of a backcourt that's capable of disrupting, you know, a lot of offenses in the league, if they can develop Christian Wood to a quality rim protector, I know that'll take some time. If they can keep Tuck around, which, you know, Lord knows what's going on over there. But I think for Steven Silas, he wants to bring a sense of versatility, and he likes Victor Oladipo's ability to be put in different situations, off the ball, on the ball, who can, you know, switch in the switching scheme, play traditional. You know, they can play a zone. And with John Wall, because the small sample size that we've seen from John Wall this season, he has been really aggressive defensively. He's looked really sharp for someone who was out for 2 years. So I think with Silas, he wants to kind of change the direction that the Rockets have been in for the last couple of years. And part of that culture is becoming, you know, a defensive stopper.
So, Kelly, there are a bunch of teams that have cap space after this season,
right?
Like a ton. And they were all saving up cap room for all these great free agents who are now not going to be free agents because they all extended. And now you look at the free agent landscape next summer, and it's basically restricted free agents and a lot of guys who have injury issues. Yeah. And one of them is Oladipo.
Yeah.
But that being said, when you have a guy who's near the top of the list in terms of best free agents and a bunch of teams with cap space, that dude's going to get paid, yeah, probably. The Rockets, I get the Rockets had a lot of money committed to Harden over the next 2 years, so it's not like they're potentially paying Oladipo if they bring him back and they get nothing off of their books. They get the Harden money off of their books. But we talk about this team all the time as a team as it's looked to get under the luxury tax the past couple of years. They have Wall's huge salary on the books. Do we even know at this point? Like, are they trying to give Oladipo big money? Because chances are he's had a good year. If he keeps having a good year, he's going to get paid. Like, are they trying to give him good big money after this year?
I think what they're trying to do is see what this group can do, at least for this season. I would say, you know, with how the era they just come from and how they're going into now, there's a lot of uncertainty in terms of what the roster looks like, what they can actually achieve, what their ceiling is. But for Victor, I mean, look, I'm not going to sit here and say the Rockets' whole plan for the future is Victor Oladipo. Like, that's just me. I'm not going to say that. But Victor is a fantastic player, and as far as extensions, I think Rafael Stone said it this weekend. He's like, they're open to anything in terms of if a player wants to stay, if they can work something out, then yeah, they would hang on to him. But Victor will get paid. There's going to be a lot of teams that have, like you said, space. And if he plays, if he can continue this season, say he averages anywhere in the range of 23, 24 points, 5 and 5, you know, 35% shooting or above from three, he will get those offers north of 30 million, 32 million. I could see that easily.
The one thing, and this is a natural segue, let's get to the other part of this trade, is kind of James in Brooklyn, is the thing that did kind of crack me up in the course of reporting this story, guys, is, and I used this anonymous quote from an executive that was part of this process, where they said that the Rockets are counting on everything blowing up in Brooklyn, and I'm paraphrasing, but it was like, that idea made me laugh because, you know, James and the Rockets, from a management ownership level, they are leaving on professional terms. Both sides said, you know, no hard feelings, and like, we wish you well. Was like, yeah, you don't really wish him well. Like, you need it to go really poorly in Brooklyn because you get all these first rounders that are obviously late first, and that's what Houston is hoping for. That, you know, the Nets put everything on the table, mortgage their future, you know, gave up control of the draft for however many years in the end, you know, and that. My understanding was, and partly to your question, Fred, that the Oladipo thing is on the side. They didn't feel like committing to LeVert. And it was about refilling the shelves with those assets. You know, they lost a ton of assets in the Westbrook deal, and they want as many bites at the apple as they can get. But again, they need the Nets to just have it fall apart in the kind of way that we know it, you know, it could, as talented as they are. And so we'll see where that goes. Jump in, guys, on – we talked a little bit about it. Well, I guess we didn't because the trade hadn't happened yet. But on the Nets side of things, I mean, maybe I got recency bias. You know, easily one of the most interesting teams that, you know, that we've had in a very long time. The Warriors were fascinating in a lot of ways, go all the way down the line. But three superstars, you know, three enigmatic personalities, and I don't really even use that word lightly. You know, it's overused, but these guys are different in their own way, and it's not a value judgment either way. But you have Kyrie, who obviously, you know, bolted out of Cleveland when he wasn't happy with being in LeBron's shadow. You know, you got James, who's, you know, kind of had three co-stars in a row in Houston that he did not find a way to make it work with. And Slater, you know, I'll throw it to you because you know this guy so well in terms of his Warriors chapter. But the idea that Kevin Durant is, you know, is the leader in the room and the guy who, you know, I'll be putting my money on more than anybody else to be able to make this work because of what he learned with the Warriors. You know, I'm not sure how I feel about that, but I think it's going to be incredibly complex between these three guys.
Yeah, I worry about Durant the least of these three, mostly because I think he's the best of these three, particularly as a two-way player. You know, when we talk about, well, can they defend? We're not really talking about can Kevin Durant defend. We're talking about can the other two defend. I'm not sure. When has Kyrie Irving ever been the third best player on the team? So that's a different pecking order from him.
Right.
And then James Harden. James Harden not only was the best player in Houston, it was a James Harden ecosystem. Everything revolved around James Harden. You
shout
can't
out
do that
Kelly with, Kelly ecosystem
hey.
Right there.
Yeah, there you go. And, you know, you mentioned Durant's days with the Warriors, and yet, like, I think a lot of times we remember them with how it kind of crumbled at the end. But that wasn't necessarily about the court product, right? I mean, they won two titles and then would have won the third if he hadn't got hurt. Like, they always succeeded on the court, really.
Right.
And there was some thorniness with, like, you know, shot distribution and you know, mostly it was just, like, media messaging and the fact that Durant never committed long-term. It was one-year deal, one-year deal, one-year deal. So right. I think he's going to be fine. He's going to get his shots. He's going to do his thing. He's going to be Kevin Durant. You know, does James Harden fit back into a non-James, you know, ecosystem again, like I said? And then Kyrie, first of all, Kyrie's got to get back on the court, which is a big thing. And then just him third in the pecking order, him probably third, you know, as far as going to, like, touch the ball, like, the third most, get the third most shots. I probably worry about him the most of the three.
Well, and to drill down on the topic, I want to talk about sacrifice. And, you know, if you look at this Nets coaching staff, and I can't wait to write about some of this stuff, and there's, you know, I'm a sucker for just the human dynamics. There's so many layers to this thing. So Steve Nash has seen it all. Like, he's a rookie coach, and I think there's legitimate questions about can he make this thing work. But Steve Nash has tried to talk Amari Stoudemire and Sean Marion off the cliff when they were pissed about not getting enough shots during the 7 seconds or less Phoenix Suns days. You know, oh, by the way, with Mike D'Antoni at his side, where, and I covered those teams, I know I'm dating myself, but like those teams, it felt like Mike D'Antoni and Steve Nash, like Steve was an assistant coach. He was not the point guard. So he's seen that. Steve has seen the Lakers in 2012-13 when it didn't go well at all. When you had Kobe, Dwight Howard, Pau Gasol, again, Mike D'Antoni, you know, Mike basically rolling his eyes every time the cameras turned off at the just the shit show that that had become with egos galore, and that didn't work. You know what I mean? That was a disaster. Then you got Mike, obviously, on this coaching staff. You know, but these guys have seen the question of sacrifice before, and, you know, they've seen it where guys did what they had to do to make it work, and they've seen it when it went the other way. You know, to me, that's all this is about, because you know, I had a guy hit me from, I guess you would say, the Durant camp that talked about how, you know, the Team USA experience that these guys have together is the best blueprint for what they need to do here. They have some experience figuring out how to share that one ball. And if they can do that, then watch out, because they're going to be in the finals, you know, taking a stab at the whole thing. But that's a huge question.
You know, there was a time where James Harden used to move a decent amount off the ball.
Yeah.
I know we've totally put it out of our minds, but like young James Harden, and it wasn't just OKC James Harden. This is earlier rendition of Houston James Harden. He was running off of pin downs at the nail and curling around screens and all that. Like, James Harden knows how to do these things. Now, so much of this kind of stuff is not necessarily basketball intellect. It's basketball habit.
Right.
And it's really, really hard to break habits that you've built up after all of those years. And a lot of it is comfort, too. You grow comfortable doing the things that you've done. And in Harden's case, that's having the entire team run through you, having the entire offense run through you, and you having the ball all the time. But But in terms of IQ, knowing how to do it, like having it actually as part of a skill set, cutting every once in a while, running off a screen every once in a while, that's possible. I'm also kind of the belief that it could look incredibly clunky and it could technically like not work however we want to define not work. It's just James Harden takes his turn and Kyrie takes his turn. And I kind of think Durant is going to make it work no matter what, just because his offensive skill set is so versatile. In Golden State, I know he'd go into the occasional ISO, but he's still just like amazing off the ball and
pretty efficient in those
open.
Isolations. Those My isolations goodness. Are, yeah.
They're well, not, that's kind of what I'm getting at. Like, yeah. These guys are going to want to ISO and they're going to want to run their own pick and rolls, but they're really good at doing those things. And they're going to have Joe Harris out there and they're going to have spacing around them. And so I kind of think it could look a little my turn, your turn, and it could look ugly. And then we're going to look at the final product and they're going to have scored 131 points.
Yeah. My question is, are the egos not bruised enough with how the shots are distributed? Or, hey, on this particular night, Kyrie, look, it's not the right matchup. You're not on, whatever. You're going to get 8 shots. You're going to score 11 points. Will you still then go on the other end and defend? Because like you said, they are going to have a top-level offensive efficiency number, however they get there, because of the talent. But do they buy into the idea of, like, to win, they need to defend? I mean, every single, you know, you need to be at least in the playoffs, like a top 5 type defense.
And they don't have the personnel to defend, which is, you know,
well, yeah,
they really just don't.
Center's the most important position defensively to a lot of people, and they traded away their best defensive center, Jared Allen. DeAndre Jordan. Now, to me, that's where I'm surprised they didn't ask for PJ Tucker in this deal. Kelly, you could tell me, like, could they have gotten PJ Tucker in this deal?
Yeah,
because, man, that would be very helpful.
And this was even in the story, but yeah, there were some, I guess if you want to call it, iterations where PJ was involved. And, you know, defensively for Brooklyn, obviously, if they score 130 a night, nobody's going to care if they give up 119 or something. But there's something that you guys talked about earlier that I wanted to touch on real quick, and it was about James. I think Fred said it. So if you go back to the bubble and you go back to the Lakers series, at how Frank Vogel was such a mastermind in setting traps, you know, hit traps and different doubles at different times in the shot clock and took Harden out of his rhythm. If you look at the stuff he said after that game, after game 5, and what he said, you know, before preseason, he wanted guys to be able to make plays without him. And maybe he said that because, you know, he wanted to, like, he wants to leave and wants the guys to get comfortable without him. But I do think that there is an element of James that's like, you don't have to have a 37.8% usage rating for 82 games in a season, you know, to win a championship. And obviously playing with Kevin Durant and Kyrie makes things a lot easier. But even if you go back to his debut, like, yeah, Kyrie wasn't there, but it seemed like James's points didn't all come, you know, at different, like, they came in the flow of a game. He didn't force the issue. And you could say that maybe he's trying to impress his teammates or it's the first game syndrome. But I do honestly think that there will be a different Harden in Brooklyn, and that's going to piss off Rockets fans for sure.
And I wonder, my thing is Kyrie's the guy for me that I have the most questions about. And partly because if you go back to his Boston chapter, right? So he tells the fans that he's going to be back. Obviously not a great move to say that publicly and then double back when it didn't go as well as you wanted. So he's got this pressure on him in terms of, you know, again, getting away from LeBron, doesn't work on his own in Boston. Now you're teaming up with Kevin at All-Star Weekend talking about possible landing spots. And this was, you know, supposed to be the Kyrie and Kevin show in Brooklyn. Now, as we reported this thing the last month or so, and I want to make sure I say this accurately, I'm not saying this is the case, but there were teams involved where their intel at different times was that Kyrie didn't want Kevin to come to Brooklyn. Now, people who definitely know what's going on say that wasn't the case. But and I don't think the trade would have happened if that was the case. But like that little seed admittedly kind of got in my mind and had me wondering about the Kyrie dynamic and the idea that, you know, now it's almost perfect that he wasn't there in James's debut in Brooklyn because obviously he's still away from the team. And that's where I just wonder where his head is going to be at. I mean, Fred, you hit on it earlier. How do you go from, you know, essentially wanting to break free from the number two role, only to in relatively short order find yourself as a number three. And then on top of that, you know, you have a lot of history between James and Kevin. These guys get on the court, and day number one, they look like they're back in OKC, you know, and comfortable with each other, know each other's games. You know, to me, Kyrie is the one that is probably worth monitoring the most as far as how he's gonna ends up fitting in.
Yeah, I honestly have no idea how that's gonna go. Like, I feel like whenever I ask anybody, how do you think this is gonna go, the answer is always just pulling something out of their ass. Right. How can we possibly sit here and guess how they're emotionally going to handle it? So I'm just kind of trying to sit down and try to figure out at least the basketball side.
Right.
Because I just genuinely have no clue how emotionally it's going to go with those three. I could see it going in any direction. I kind of tend to be a winning breeds chemistry over chemistry breeds winning kind of guy. And I feel like this could be one of those cases. But like, look, hey man,
covering the Wizards, what the hell you know about winning?
Kyrie's got to play first. I know a lot about teams that aren't playing right now. Right. Kyrie's got to actually get on the court.
Kyrie's not telling us what's the problem either. And you know, you mentioned guessing. He's got his franchise guessing. It seems like, you know, he was missing work for like 10 days. And
as an aside, especially sitting here on MLK Day, pretty damn cool the news that came out from Steven Jackson today that Kyrie bought George Floyd's family a home. We've talked on the pod before about, like, you know, there's no hot takes coming from here. Let Kyrie speak for himself whenever that time comes. But on the basketball side, there's a ripple effect here. And, you know, I just wonder how it's going to work with him. And, oh, by the way, guys, James admitted in his press conference, somebody asked him very directly whether he had talked to Kevin and Kyrie about, like, elements of sacrifice and how this could work. And listen, I don't know if he was telling the truth, but if we're taking him at his word, he just very definitively said they had not talked about this stuff at all, which blew my mind. Because to me, you know, you want to be having that job interview, so to speak, and talking to these guys to get a comfort level before you decide to jump. So if that's true, I mean, that, you know, kind of made me wonder even more how it's going to go.
Would we all agree that Kevin Durant and James Harden are clearly the two best players on this team?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's just how NBA pecking orders work. Kyrie Irving, if this doesn't go well this year, Kyrie Irving will very likely be the name that will be floated out there as, like, you know, hey, get Kyrie to get pieces that might fit. And Kyrie's, you know, not, you know, he probably understands that too. So, yes, I agree with you. Like, spotlight is on him because he's probably going to have to sacrifice the most shots, and he's probably has the shakiest future on the franchise, right? I could see James and Kevin going, look, you know, we did our thing in the playoffs, so we might need to figure something out.
Right.
Otherwise, we're a long way away from that. But yeah, they're just, those dynamics are at play, and I assume Kyrie knows that, right? He probably knows he's the third best player on the team, and that's just, I mean.
But this was his plan. That's where I guarantee you it's not going to land well. This was his plan, you know, I mean.
His plan was to be the number two.
I mean, I think it really comes down to who's taking that last shot. You know, if it comes down to a game and it's 109, 108, and there's 11 seconds left, all three are going to be asking for the ball. So who's going to get that ball?
Right.
Joe Harris. Joe Harris is going to get the ball. That's how it works. Steve Kerr took the shot. That's how it's going to work. Yeah. Paxton took the shot.
As we speak, I'm staring at my TV above my laptop here. Man, it looks weird to see James in that jersey. I almost felt like he should. The Nets game is starting. I felt like he should have shaved the beard just to, like, have a complete clean slate. But I think he's probably never going to do that. But there it is, James Harden in that Nets jersey. All right, gentlemen, let's pivot. And Kelly, you're more than welcome to jump into the next topic. If you got to go, let me know. You've had a long couple days. By the way, guys, Kelly bounced from Houston to San Antonio and back. Covering games, jump. Did they have you up in the rafters?
Dude, that is the worst arena in the world. I'm sorry. AT&T Center.
I don't disagree. AT&T
Center.
I do not disagree.
I'm sorry. For all the talk of Spurs culture and stuff like that, maybe it's because the fans weren't there, but That building has no swag to it. Like, I was just sitting there like, what the hell?
And you're going to get Tom James, way Spurs, out of downtown. Collins.
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No.
Yeah, don't let me get started on the San Antonio City Planners, because that's the...
Kelly, you don't consider the fact that they promote that they've won the Rodeo of the Year like 12 straight years as a swag?
They're the only contestant. It's like saying, it's like the episode of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia where Max talking about his mom being the head of Jiffy Lube and Charlie saying there's only three people that work there. It's not a pretty... I'm sorry.
Like this. Kel, you got to come back more. We don't have enough pop culture on here, man. Hey, I like that.
Fred has all that for me. Fred got it.
There you go. There you go. All right, Kel. Thank you, man. We appreciate Peace. You. Great job on the story.
Yes, sir. I'll take care.
All right. Be good. All right, guys. This is going to be right up Fred's alley. Fred, I know you like the game of basketball. You enjoy covering the game of basketball. You ain't covering any basketball right now, my friend. You are covering the medical beat. COVID continues to do its thing within the NBA circles. I might have lost track, and tell me if you guys have the updated number here. I think after a game got postponed today, we are now talking about 18 postponements in all, 17 in the last 8 days. And that involves, I don't have the exact number, but more than half the league, 16 plus and probably in the 20 area. The question I want to get to, listeners don't want to talk about COVID sports in a lot of ways, are just a way to get away from those kinds of tough realities. But we are having, I think, you know, a situation where it's now time to debate the substance of this season and the good old kind of asterisk question. These games are hard to gauge because guys are out, guys are in, guys are out, guys are in. So, you know, what does a win mean? What does a loss mean? I guess in general, where are you guys at on, you know, the challenge the league is navigating and the impact it's having on the game and the sport itself?
So I think there are levels to this, because ultimately, if it affects a champion, we're going to put some sort of asterisk. You know, that's just the way it's going to work. If, you know, you looked at that Sixers-Nuggets game from a couple of weeks ago, and the Sixers right. had a couple of rookies playing 40-some-odd minutes.
Right.
What if that's game six in a 3-2 playoff series and a team finds itself in
you
that situation?
You see it in football right now in the playoffs. I mean, the same type of deal. Like 15, the Browns had 15 guys, you know, on COVID protocol.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy. And so if you end up with that kind of situation in a playoff game, like, yeah, there's an asterisk. But I think there are levels to this too, where it's not in the bubble, for example, when we were talking about, is there an asterisk on this champion? We were just talking about it in relation to the champion. And by the way, I really don't think there is one. In retrospect, that's a legit title with the way that it played out. But
agreed.
For example, I think teams are going to have asterisks on their own season. So for example, the one that I cover, the Wizards, they come into this year where they're saying, all right, we're experimenting with Beal and Westbrook, and this might be the year. And they get off to a bad start, and they're 3-8. And now they're just ravaged by COVID, right? And they haven't played a game in over a week, and they haven't had a practice. And now they have an excuse where when they come back, they're very, very possibly, if not likely, going to be missing a pretty significant chunk of their roster. And now all of a sudden they can look back on it and say, oh, well, you know, we had the terrible situation where so many of our guys were in protocol for so long, we couldn't practice, we came back, we played with an incomplete roster, and then the season just got out of hand. And if it weren't for that, maybe we end up coming back and turning things around. I feel like we were right there. And there are going to be so many, I think, situations throughout the league as these sorts of situations start to compile. And the Wizards have the worst one. But, you know, we've seen players with the Mavs in health and safety protocol. And, you know, all around the league, we've seen guys, teams in bad situations where it's just like teams are going to find it difficult to evaluate themselves and evaluate their own future and evaluate right. What should we do at the deadline? Because we don't really have a good feel for our roster or anything like that. So I think there are like asterisks all around, to be honest.
Yeah. The one thing that I think will benefit the league is the reality that the playoffs, I think they start in May is the expectation. I know that's somewhat of a floating date. The second half of the schedule hasn't even been created. But I'm very optimistic we're going to be in a very different world come May. I mean, I talked to some people who were like, you know, maybe some form of fans will be in the arenas by playoff time, you know, with this vaccine rollout, which admittedly seems to be
there's some now, just not in your neck of the woods. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think we'll get to the playoffs, and I think the 1-8 bracket, I should say 1-10 with the play-in, will feel pretty representative, right? I mean, when we're talking about titles and if we're putting asterisks on titles, look, we know the Lakers are going to be in the playoffs, the Bucks, the Nets, like the Clippers, the teams that we actually think have a chance will be there. And I think by the time we get there, we'll see. I might be wrong, but I don't think we're going to be dealing with like team wide outbreaks and stuff, just because I think the world is going to be getting somewhat back to normal, at least as far as what I'm reading. I'm certainly not an expert.
Well, and this, listen, that kind of leads right into this. The vaccination question is super interesting. I wrote about it last week a little bit. You know, right out the gate, when people around the country and the world started trying to figure out when the vaccine would be available, obviously several companies had created one. Adam Silver comes out and says, we're not going to cut the line with players. You know, morally, they didn't want to do that. Now, and this, I think, is something that people would have different opinions about. There is some chatter, and this is what I got into, that they are exploring different ways in which there could be a win-win potentially between the NBA and government and, you know, the new administration that's coming in. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and their transition team has been in touch with the NBA about this topic. So the one idea that was told to me was that, you know, all over the country, you're going to obviously have vaccine distribution centers. And the idea would be that, you know, what if, and again, nothing concrete, just discussions, but what if players became, you know, kind of, you know, spokesmen for this vaccine push? We all know that specifically in the African-American community, there's a lot of understandable skepticism about vaccines. There was a Pew poll back in mid-November that had the percentage at 42%, around 12,000, I think, people were polled, and 42% of African Americans said that they would take the vaccine. You're talking 58 who didn't want to. So whether it's Steph Curry, Bradley Beal, LeBron James out there at a distribution center telling people, hey, look at me, I'm getting the vaccine, you should do it too. And then within that, hey, guess what? Now they're vaccinated. I don't know the timing of something like that, but they're looking for, whether you call them workarounds or just kind of creative ways to do that, so that, you know, what's happening right now for them and their product stops happening.
One thing that I wonder is, and I have no idea what the answer is, but the NBA tends to be a pretty solid representation of the rest of the country in terms of what its populace believes. You know, people say, you know, 50% of NBA players are smart and 50% of NBA players aren't as smart, because when you take a random sampling of 450 people, they tend to reflect the larger sample size, right? So what I wonder is what percentage of NBA players want to take the vaccine, because how the league is going to handle that, how the league is going to handle any sort of vaccine mandate or anything along those lines, because ultimately the league is going to run a lot smoother if all of its players are vaccinated, or at least the vast majority of its players are vaccinated. I know we know a couple guys, Michael Porter Jr., Dwight Howard.
Yeah.
who have said some stuff about vaccines that I know we don't agree with, and that aren't true about vaccines. And so I'm sure
it's
there
pretty
are other
damn
players
understandable
out there
though,
who are on
if I'm
the
being
same
honest. Not to get into, you know, I mean, that's the one thing I want to measure is I'm certainly taking the vaccine. My family certainly is going to, but the more I've learned about the reason that the skepticism exists in that particular community, I would encourage people who don't know to do some research and be empathetic as to why folks want to ask questions. Now, yes, I agree. The trust and the, you know, should be there, and it's incredibly important for folks to take it. But, you know, the more I learned about that, it's enlightening about why a lot of people are thinking twice and three times about taking it.
Yeah, and I think the answer is do not mandate anyone take it, but play people who within the league who have taken it will, I assume, have a lot looser protocols than the people who haven't. And, you know, eventually either somebody's like who's so against taking it that they're willing to remain under the strict protocols will do that, or they'll go, look, I kind of want to. Just like I think our society goes, well, I kind of want to get back to normal, so I guess I might have to take it.
Right.
So I think that's probably the best way to do it, where you can't mandate an employee do it, but it's like, look, it's basically like getting the golden ticket to back to reality.
Right.
And that's for all of us, right? Like, I want to get back in arenas. You guys want to.
I wonder if the education has begun from the part of the league yet, and I don't know if that's the case or not. I had a player hit me the other day and was asking very general questions about the vaccine because he had seen what I wrote. And, you know, I wrote back that, you know, you're talking 95% efficacy, and just the immediate response was, all right, sign me up. Sounds good. You know, so I'm sure.
Yeah, I know. I actually know a few people who have gotten it now at this point. My in-laws. Yeah, I have a friend who's a firefighter, so first responder. He's gotten it. So it's starting to trickle out there for sure.
It is indeed. All right, gentlemen, let's end with this. We're going to have a little bit of fun on this week's pod and talk about surprises to this season. There's a long list. We're each coming with one. And I think Fred and I spoiled ours, and Slater's the mystery man.
You two go first, since we already know.
Fair
enough.
You're
going to stay east, Sam. We know you're staying east.
I know.
So,
you always think I'm the east guy.
Cuts off half the league.
All right. I'm staying east, and it's not the most creative outside-the-box contribution, but it is thematic with this week's pod because we talked a lot about James Harden. There was a time when I really wondered if Raptors president Masai Ujiri would kind of have a deja vu all over again experience and go after Harden in the same way he had Kawhi Leonard a couple of years ago, a fairly similar state of the franchise type situation. You know, DeMar DeRozan back then was Pascal Siakam. Now, would he take that kind of a leap and try to, you know, get their franchise another superstar? And he didn't. And in lieu of that, my surprise is just the Raptors and how bad they've been. Now, my timing's not great. They've won 3 out of 5, but they're still 4-8. And beyond the fact that they are, you know, the champions once removed, it's just the fact that in the bubble, covering that team against Boston and other games, you really got a sense of their championship grit. And that's like this nebulous concept that sometimes probably gets overblown. But I remember watching their games and, you know, the attitude from Fred VanVleet and different guys and Siakam. I didn't necessarily imagine this team stumbling to this degree. And it's all the way down the line. I mean, it's Lowry, Siakam, VanVleet, you know, guys who typically just play better. They have not got the job done, and Nick Nurse didn't forget how to coach, but man, they are struggling big time.
Their center position was destructive this season, right? With Serge going to LA, Mark right. going to LA, the other right. LA team, right. And I think, you know, Baines hadn't played that well, but they seem to be finding something with Boucher right now, which was, you know, that was a Warriors two-way
guy. I was
going to
say former Warrior.
Yeah, yeah, that, you know, trust me, they could maybe use him. But I think they're going to have a good run coming up. Like you said, they've won 2 in a row. They're playing currently right now as we speak. So at this point, it might be 3 in a row. I don't know. But yeah, but also, you know, Lowry's like, how old's Lowry now?
I'm going to handicap it. Let's take bets here as I look it up. Come and say Kyle's
33, 34.
I was going to say 33, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Things would be a lot different for them, by the way, if two Siakam shots,
that'd be 34.
Yeah. If two Siakam shots go down, or if two Siakam shots become unnecessary because on the previous possession those shots don't go down.
Yeah.
All of a sudden they're 6-6, and we're talking about them in a different kind of tone right now.
True. You mentioned Siakam though. Like, remember, like 2 years ago, or as he was kind of beginning his rise, like, we all probably thought, like, at this point in time, he would be an all-NBA forward, like, perennial all-star. And he just hasn't made that leap. You know, he's kind of plateaued, maybe even gone a little bit down. And that's a big problem for them.
Indeed. Yeah, no question. I also, I think this has to be part of the conversation every time we talk about the Raptors struggling. Like, those dudes picked up from Toronto, moved to Tampa as a team on short notice. I mean, imagine if we were just displaced individually from the place
that
we live.
That's
we had to live out
of
a hotel. Of course they're not playing like themselves. Like, how could anyone in any sort of work environment get displaced to another country in a random city in the South and have to live there, live out of a hotel, and on top of that, not have the have all of the restrictions you have to live with as well. So it's not like you can just chill in your home, you know? That's hard. It's hard from a lifestyle perspective.
It's funny you say that, because I talked to somebody who had spoken to somebody within the Raptors, because the Raptors just did a West Coast trip that included, they came out to San Francisco, and the Raptors were saying how wild it is, how different country it is, basically, where they were out in California, everything's closed, everyone's wearing a mask, you know, the pandemic has everything shut down. Meanwhile, they're in Tampa, a city that is very foreign to them, very foreign to the NBA, and there's filled bars that are maskless. They said maybe 20% of the people are walking around in masks. And yeah, as that's all swirling around, as you're trying to avoid an outbreak on your team, it is a good point by Fred. Like, that's probably uprooted their
team. It's also the fact that we overlook it is indicative of that we're all stuck in our houses watching games on TV. Like, it's not real anymore. You know what I mean? Like, I watch the Raptors play, and it's a passing thought that they're actually in Tampa. So, very good point, Fred. Fred, what is your surprise?
My surprise is my most improved player candidate, which I think Jeremy Grant is like the ideal most improved player. Like, I voted for Tatum. I voted for Ingram last year.
Certainly improved as well.
Yes, no question. I voted for Ingram last year, but I kind of thought Ingram was just kind of the boring most improved player, as would Tatum have been, as would even Bam have been, a young guy early in his career, high first round pick, makes a leap, and that's it. Jeremy Grant, second round pick. He's been around for years. He bet on himself to a degree this offseason. He said that.
I don't even think a degree, like, really bet on himself.
Yeah. I mean, he did that great piece with James Edwards where James talked about how black leadership there in Detroit was a big reason why I decided to go there. That was a really cool piece, by the way. People should check that out.
Yeah.
And but on top of that, he wants to be the number one guy.
Right. I want to fill in the gaps real quick, Fred. Like, the night that he signed, the Nuggets were confused. They were confused. Like, we don't get it. We gave you the same offer that the Pistons gave you. You just went to the Western Conference Finals. And what are we missing? And they didn't get it. Now, you mentioned the piece that James Edwards wrote. James did a great job. And that really helped you understand where Jeremy's head was at. It's not only one of the few black heads of a front office in the NBA. It's a black head coach in Dwayne Casey. And Jeremy, you know, that was meaningful to him. But, you know, the basketball side was that offensively, you know, there were folks on the Denver side who just were confused, partly because they just had gotten used to seeing him clean up everybody else's junk offensively and didn't know that he wanted to grow like he wanted to. And he's opening a lot of eyes with his ability to do that.
Who other than Jeremy Grant saw this coming?
Right.
You know, when we heard word that he wanted a bigger offensive role, he wanted to be a guy who could handle the ball and create buckets for himself. We never saw him come close to doing that at all. You know, there were times earlier in his career before he became more of a spot up guy when he was in Philly and OKC where he'd get the ball and he wouldn't really have a move. He'd go through the legs. It wouldn't take him anywhere. And then he would just kind of barrel at the rim and he became pretty good at drawing fouls, but that was kind of his only thing. And like you look at it now, Blake Griffin's giving them nothing. I mean, Blake Griffin is giving them nothing. And his usage rate, he's never had a usage rate above 18%. Which means basically he's been responsible for less than a fifth of the offense every single year of his career. So below average, which is 20%. He's up to 26 now, by far his career high, and his efficiency has remained exactly the same. Normally those two things have an inverse relationship. He's scoring incredibly efficiently. He's averaging 25 a game. I mean, he's doubled his scoring now. The passing needs to get better. I think in some ways the decision-making needs to get a little better, but his shot selection's been really good. He looks smooth. He looks comfortable. He's going to average 20-something a game this year. We'll see if he stays at 25. He's shooting 39% from three, but which he's always done, but now he's taking twice as many threes. He's just been really impressive, and I just never saw this coming. He's a really good player.
Troy Weaver should get some credit too.
100%.
You know, as far as people who saw it coming, I assume Troy Weaver did. You know, I didn't love his summer, you know, his initial summer in the front office, but part of the bad marks Troy was getting, you know, I guess league wide by national writers was assuming that the Grant contract wasn't good, but it's turned out, at least so far, like, you know, how many teams now, if you put Jeremy Grant back out on the market right now, would say, yeah, we'll take him for that contract? I think a lot. So,
by the way, he's also the best defensive player on the Pistons.
Yeah, I mean, you know, not low bar, but yeah.
No, but he's a good defender. He's good. Guards every position. Versatile, Sam, smart.
I agree, and I'll do the transition to my surprise because it coincides. I'll go west because Sam wants to tilt everything so easy.
I do. But hold on. Before you pivot, Slater, I just got a shout out because you talked about the contracts on the Pistons. John Hollinger, I think John's probably okay, and obviously the Athletic Zone and legendary John Hollinger. I think John's probably good with the Grant contract. The Mason Plumlee one is the one that he's tweeted about at least a dozen times and that sends him over the edge. One. You know, 3 years, $25 million. Combined
with the Dwayne Dedman stretch that, you know, it was...
Yes,
that was
yes,
a lot.
Yeah.
Okay, continue. My surprise. Nikola Jokic leads the NBA in assists right now, and he's, I would say, probably a top three MVP candidate. I mean, the guy's taking his game to another level, really kind of trampolining off the playoffs, yet Denver is not even in the playoffs right now. They're 6-7. And I just think that's my surprise. You know, you combine those two together. If I told you the type of opening to the season Nikola Jokic is having, yet, you know, the team that was in the West Finals last year right now, I think it's like the 11th seed at 6-7. It's kind of a stunner. And the reason why I said it coincides with Grant is because what Fred's mentioning, they're missing Jeremy Grant's defense. They're missing some of that supplementary scoring. They're missing Michael Porter Jr., who's been in COVID protocols now for, I think, about 2 or 3 weeks.
And he actually had COVID. Malone had a little bit of a slip-up and shared that the other day.
Yeah. Jamal Murray, you know, it was kind of the bubble doubt. You know, Sam, you were giving me a little bit of hell when I even questioned if Jamal Murray was going to maintain that.
Damn it.
He's been back to Jamal Murray from past years, right? Which is hot and cold. You know, 12.
Man, forget about Jamal. I don't need to hear about Jamal Murray. What about me, guys? What about me and my work in the bubble versus now? Like, did I have a good run in the bubble and I'm a fraud and now I'm back to my normal standards? What about the NBA writer
perennial
bubble effect?
He's a perennial all star. Although I wanted to hear some more Amick Sacramento Kings takes. I saw some of that game yesterday. That's where you're missing.
No,
defense. Oh my God, that Kings defense.
Well, no, but you know what's funny is Kelly mentioned, I think it was Kelly, just the COVID effect and how it's hard to read all these things and plan and I think he was talking about what the Rockets are gonna do going forward. The Kings, and I need to make some calls on this, like normally, you know, I'd be hitting up a lot of folks right now trying to find out if Luke Walton was in trouble. You know what I mean? And like the hot seat topic all over the NBA is going to be interesting to monitor this time around because, again, if you can't figure out, you know, what these different games mean, then how culpable do you find the coaches? I think it's going to be a different calculus because of the uniqueness of the landscape. But anyway you cut it, Kings got off to an okay start. Their defense is just atrocious, you know. But, I mean, if they did something with Luke, you know, Alvin Gentry sitting there as his right-hand man. And you know, I love Alan, but he's never been, you know, a defensive-minded coach. So I don't know what they're going to do, but that has definitely been ugly the last couple of weeks.
All right. Well, see, I roped him into it.
You did. You did.
They're giving up 120 points per 100 possessions, by the way.
It's amazing.
Marvin Bagley has a lot to do with that.
All right,
it's
gentlemen.
It's really rough.
No Kings talk. It's depressing. It's the locals are very upset about this. Thank you for the time. Always a good time. We enjoyed breaking down all things James Harden. It's MLK Day. Hopefully you get a little breather tonight. Watch this next Nets-Bucks game and do your thing. But appreciate you guys. Thanks for coming on.
Sam, I do not have a breather. Lakers, Warriors is the nightcap. So, yeah, I'm going to cover that.
You only have 70. You got 16 other Warriors riders. Can't you just pass the bye?
Oh, my. No, this is an interesting one. The listeners will have already known how it went down. But, yes, Lakers, Warriors, nightcap.
All right, well, for damn it, Slater, since you wrote me into Kings Talk, you know, 45 seconds, the Warriors are still very interesting. What do you make of the latest iteration? You know, a couple of W's, and lately they can't defend enough to finish it off. What are we making of the Warriors right now?
Draymond Green is their barometer. They were terrible without him. And then he came back and looked like himself. And they had a really good homestand where he looked refreshed and back to at least the 2019 version, even though he does not score at all. He's just everything else he does. And then they went into Denver and he played arguably the worst defensive game I've ever seen him play. And they played poor defensively. And, you know, I don't know how many full throttle Draymond Green defensive games he has in the tank this year. But if you told me that number, I would give you their likely number of wins, because like right now that's where I'm at on them. Like, they'll be good defensively if he's good, and they won't if he's not. So
that's very good. Fred, here's to hoping you start covering actual basketball again. Hang in there, brother.
Oh, I just hope everybody's healthy, and then and then we get to do the thing that we like, which is watch basketball and talk about basketball.
No doubt. All right, guys, appreciate you. Have a good week.